Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 1005 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser med mig Ronny Berggren och till del 76 i Miserium USAs presidentval 2020. En serie som kan stödjas på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0. Den 3 februari närmar sig dagen när Iowa med sin caucus skjuter startskottet för primärvalsracen i USA. Här följer ett samtal med den amerikanske politiska experten Justin White som återkommande deltagit på amerikanska nyhetsanalyser sedan 2015 och varför just Iowa är så viktigt i amerikanska presidentval. Varmt välkomna! Justin White, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Ronnie.
It's in a couple of weeks, actually. It's going to be the caucus in Iowa, the start of the primary season in the Democratic nomination process. And, you know, to begin with, when did Iowa start to become important in presidential elections?
So it depends a little bit, of course. You know, obviously the Republican and Democratic parties have a primary system with which you're listeners are probably at least vaguely aware, rather than a nominating convention, which is more common in European politics. You know, obviously, sometimes we have an open race, like for instance in 2016 when there was no incumbent and therefore both the Republican and the Democratic parties were a free-for-all, whereas, of course, President Trump is the incumbent Republican. And so really, while there is technically a Republican primary process that occurs, it's basically a joke because, of course, he's going to get the overwhelming majority of votes in every state. And so it's really a non-event. So it's really left to the Democrats, similar to in 2012 when it was lopsided and Obama technically had a Democratic primary, but it was of no consequence. So really the Iowa caucuses and their importance can be pointed to rather dramatically in the Democratic side. For Jimmy Carter in 1976, he won, and that kind of uplifted this nobody, quote unquote, governor of Georgia, and he ultimately, of course, would become president of the United States. So that's really a strong tie down point. Also, Ronald Reagan had a strong effect as well in 76, running against Gerald Ford, who was ironically the incumbent Republican president, but who had never been elected president or even vice president, of course, due to the Nixon impeachment and Spiro Agnew's resignation. So it was an interesting situation in which the Republican primary was rather robust, despite having a Republican incumbent president, technically speaking. So really, 76 is kind of the tie down point. It happened before then, but it wasn't seen as a jarring and important event prior to that year, really.
Very interesting. What is the difference? Like I said, it's called caucus in Iowa, and after that comes the primary in New Hampshire, and it's basically the same process, but not the same technical thing. What is the difference between a primary and a caucus?
So there's actually quite a major distinction between them. So a primary vote is very similar to what most of your listeners would be familiar with, right? Going into the election booth, marking the ticket for whomever you wish to in the various races, including, you know, President of the United States most famously. But obviously there's other elections going on for town council and governor and Congress, and these other sorts of things are usually on the ballot as well in most states for their primaries. But the caucus is a very different animal altogether. So to cast your ballot in a caucus, you don't merely walk into a voting booth. You have to go out, and keep in mind, Iowa is a northern state in the United States, very similar to New Hampshire in this regard. And so cold weather and snow and ice are quite plausible. And in fact, sometimes Iowa caucus is held in an outright blizzard, depending on, you know, weather situations. And the caucus, the way that it works, is you actually have to go to what's called a caucus site or similar to an election polling place. And you have to sit there for hours on end as they vote in rounds. And you actually have to stand up, and your vote is not secret. You have to stand up next to your neighbors, and you have to declare yourself for a candidate. So it's actually quite a different process. And it tends to reward campaigns whose supporters are very, very strongly supporting them, as opposed to just people who, you know, if they had 5 minutes, could dash in between coffee or work or picking up the kids to go vote for them, which is more similar around the rest of the elections that are held. And so the Iowa caucuses uniquely reward strong support. Likewise, you have to get to at least 15% of the vote in that actual building or caucus site, or else your team is scattered and they have to choose another candidate to back or go home. So very similar to ranked choice voting, which some European voters will be familiar with. We don't actually have ranked choice voting in America, but this is one of those instances where we kind of do. And so a lot of times you'll have caucus site directors striking deals with lesser campaigns. So for instance, you know, as we know, a lot of Elizabeth Warren voters and Bernie Sanders voters have similar values. They're not exactly the same, but they're more similar. Likewise, Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden. So for instance, if there's a township or a voting precinct where Pete Buttigieg is at 12%, but Joe Biden is at 18, you know, rather than let Pete Buttigieg's voters just go home, Biden and Buttigieg may strike a deal in which Buttigieg's voters in that precinct come over and vote for Joe Biden, but with the understanding that in another precinct somewhere else in Iowa, the exact opposite is going to happen, and they trade off, and there's a bit of horse trading. It's actually very, very fascinating process that's unlike anything else in the country.
I can imagine. You know, they talk a lot about that retail politics is very, very important in the, you know, in the early states like Iowa and New Hampshire, and both have the have one thing in common. They're very small states. It's easy to travel all across the states in a couple of days. But does the caucus process makes retail politics even more important?
Absolutely, and also, you know, your endorsements start to matter a lot more, because of course if the mayor of the town who's quite beloved is your man at the caucus site, well, then that tends to, you know, because there's still undecided voters who come out to this. And, you know, and that the speeches that they give, kind of like a nominating speech at a convention, you know, can be quite rousing, because you sit there and go, oh, well, that's Tom, and I know Tom, and Tom's my mayor. And so if he's backing Joe Biden, well, maybe that's the deciding, you know, point for me. Or likewise, you know, on the opposite side, if some candidates and campaigns are such that you're either with them or against them, a campaign that comes to mind is Romney's campaign, both in 2012 and 2008, but especially in 2008. And he was one of those candidates that if you weren't with him, he wasn't your second or even your third choice. You know, you tended to either like Romney a lot or you really didn't like him, which meant that in a caucus site where he was doing poorly, no one would help him. You know, no one would work with him. Whereas there was some, you can develop a bit of camaraderie, and you even see it in the debates when you see candidates kind of working together to maybe put Elizabeth Warren, you know, in her place, or perhaps like Kamala Harris and some of the others all attacking Joe Biden at one point. You begin to see some alliances starting to form. And this tends to matter a lot more come the Iowa caucuses.
You know, you are a political advisor and a political expert. Have you ever been working in Iowa in a caucus process?
Yeah, so as a matter of fact, in 2008, when I was rather high up with the Governor Huckabee's campaign, I helped lead both his Iowa straw poll and Iowa caucus operations, and got to see it firsthand. I'm one of the few normal human beings who's done what is lovingly nicknamed the full Grassley, which is going to every single one of Iowa's 99 counties. And I can promise you that more than half of them are shockingly rural and with low population. But it was an experience, absolutely.
But how does the, you know, day-to-day life in Iowa work? Because, you know, everyone knows that the candidates go there and they try to, you know, visit all the 99 counties. But for someone who, you know, tries to organize the campaign, how does the day-to-day work actually work for a campaign advisor like you?
So there's a local chain of restaurants that's rather ubiquitous in Iowa called the Pizza Ranch. And it's kind of a low rent version of a Domino's or Papa John's or Pizza Hut, which some of your listeners may be familiar. And You know, I joke that I've spent more time in pizza ranches than any human being ought to, because in many cases, they're kind of the only fast food joint or coffee shop style place to meet up with in a lot of these very rural counties. So it's a lot of face-to-face meetings with local folks, you know, school board presidents and mayors and city councilmen, people who matter quite a lot in their little towns and smaller counties, but, you know, whom even people in Des Moines, Iowa, you know, have never really heard of or care about, frankly. You know, there's a handful of larger cities that represent probably 60% of the population of the state, like Des Moines, Cedar Falls, and Davenport and Ames. But then there's literally just hundreds of these small towns, oftentimes with no more than 50 or 100 people in them. And so you really have to get out there and talk to them. There's a lot of phone calls and a lot of kind of phone tree conference call type stuff. And it's very, very small town politics, probably comparable to things in northern Sweden would be a good example in my estimation.
Yeah. You know, let's jump to the, you know, the present election. A couple of days ago, Julian Castro, just before he dropped out, he said something like, Iowa is not diverse enough. And by that, he meant like that there are only white peoples in Iowa, and that is not good. Was that only a provocation, or was he serious, or was he like, why did he say that?
Well, you know, winners never complain about the process, right? So there's something to be said for that. That being said, you know, the problem, you know, with the diversity argument, and it comes up every 4 years, and especially more so on the Democratic side, you know, and the media, of course, leans to, a bit liberal, so they tend to carry water for that. But one of the realities is that there's only a few states that are suitable for this, right? The reality is there's only about a dozen states in America that are not, you know, fairly sizable states. And you want to make these states small in terms of population so that, you know, people who might be viewed, especially at the outset, as a second tier candidate, have a chance. The reality is if we started with states like New York or Illinois or California or Texas, then only candidates who were worth hundreds of millions of dollars or who were already very, very powerful would have any chance at all, because they'd need to run media campaigns in front of, you know, tens of millions of people. And it's just preposterous. You know, the other reality is, though, there is a little bit of racial, you know, homogeny to states like New Hampshire and Iowa, although not as much so as there would be in, say, Idaho or Utah or other states. So I do think the diversity argument is slightly overplayed. Cities like Des Moines, Iowa, for instance, have more than 10% African American population. So it's not a total white place. That being said, these are purple states, right? It's important to remember that both Barack Obama and George W. Bush and Donald Trump won New Hampshire and Iowa. So they're actually diverse in terms of political thinking. And if you want to make your argument before a group of people who might go either way, then these are two very good states. A third state was kind of added to that mix in Nevada, and it likewise has been won by both George W. Bush and Barack Obama. So, you know, I do think it's good to have these smaller states that are actually swing states. And the truth is there aren't many, right? If you go to states like Wyoming or North and South Dakota, which are equally small, or Alaska, in terms of populations, they haven't voted for a Democrat in 40 years, so it doesn't make sense to make them an early state. You know, so, you know, and the truth is that South Carolina is actually far more African American than any other state in America, other than Mississippi. So one could argue the exact opposite there, that it's too black, right? It's why Jesse Jackson won it in 88, despite having no real chance of actually winning the presidency. Or even the Democratic nomination. You know, Barack Obama won it by something like 30 points, which is, again, given how close the election was between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, quite preposterous to have a 30-point victory. So, you know, I think the diversity argument is trotted out, you know, every 4 years, but I don't think it's real. And I think the alternative would be to take the race to places where only campaigns with multi-millions of dollars could succeed. And ironically, Julian Castro would have been even worse off, right? Pete Buttigieg did not have a massive war chest or massive name ID. And he's polling in tied for first, along with Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden in Iowa. So I think that speaks well to the Iowa process.
Yeah. You know, this must be like the record of candidates in, you know, U.S. election history, presidential history. And a lot of them are smaller candidates, and all of them, like Amy Klobuchar and a lot of others, they try to get a jump start in Iowa. They want, you know, to win Iowa to get momentum in the later, you know, primary states. Do you think that the big field of candidates, does that make Iowa even more important in this presidential cycle than in earlier presidential cycles?
Well, I mean, we have seen large fields before. I mean, certainly in 2016, between the Democrats and the Republicans, there was quite a big field, you know, as there was in 08. But that being said, the large number of candidates certainly only magnifies the importance of states like Iowa and New Hampshire, you know, because the truth of the matter is, you know, while you don't necessarily have to win Iowa, we have seen people lose Iowa and go on to be the president. You know, you're not finishing in seventh place in Iowa with any credibility, you know, and especially if you don't finish in the top two or three in Iowa or New Hampshire, you're really, really, your campaign's probably dead, as Rudy Giuliani discovered, right, in 2008 when he ran hoping to start a victory roll in Florida, which was the fourth state at the time. And, of course, it never materialized, and he basically dropped out right after Florida. That, by the way, is the interesting side note to Mike Bloomberg's campaign, which, as if your listeners are paying attention to the polls, he's now polling in fifth place nationally. So he's jumped up ahead of everyone but Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg nationwide. He's eclipsed everyone else. So, you know, his campaign, whilst thoroughly unconventional, is seeming to work a little bit. And of course, he has the added benefit of having what amounts to a nearly endless checking account. And he's been spending well over $30 million per week, which is quite a staggering amount of money. And it's working. So there's a really good chance that a month from now, he could very well be polling in, you know, another 5 or 6% higher, which would put him in, you know, third or fourth place, and at which point he would start picking up delegates, and it could lead to a brokered convention, but we're still quite a long ways off from that, of course.
Yeah, but Michael Bloomberg, he's not, you know, he will not try to win Iowa. He will try to win on Super Tuesday in those like 16 states. Is that, that's, you know, true. Do you think that's even possible to win, you know, after other candidates have won, like Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina?
It's a very difficult path, to be sure. Again, you know, as I mentioned, Rudy Giuliani attempted something similar, and failed miserably. But the other reality is that Michael Bloomberg's seemingly true dedication to this commitment, but financially, is different. It's more similar to a Ross Perot candidacy, which was certainly not without, you know, regard. You know, it changed the fate of American politics that year. In 92 and again in 96, even when he ran. Now, so Michael Bloomberg has the ability. One of the things that's, you know, to be honest, when you look at the campaign finance numbers, which is the other, you know, they call it the invisible primary in America. The other reality is that Elizabeth Warren's fundraising has fallen off rather dramatically. And Joe Biden's has picked back up. He was in real trouble a few months ago, but it seems like he's back on a good mark. Bernie Sanders is doing incredibly well financially, and Pete Buttigieg is doing very well financially as well. And so you can see a situation, you know, emerging where, you know, if Pete Buttigieg or Bernie Sanders were to win Iowa, which seems very possible, and then in New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders were to win again, you know, Joe Biden is going to be in real trouble. He probably still wins South Carolina, but at that point, his campaign is in real, real trouble. And is also probably struggling financially. And Michael Bloomberg seems to be running more in the lane of Joe Biden than, say, Bernie Sanders. And so one can see a situation where Michael Bloomberg spends $100 to $250 million in places like I think Michael Bloomberg stands to potentially win New York and New Jersey. And just the two of those states alone represent 8% of the delegates for the entire country. Mm. Likewise, I think he would do very well, probably not winning, but coming in second or third in California, you know, where his money will go far. Likewise, in places like Texas and Florida, some of these very big, very expensive states, where if you don't have $20 million to spend on advertising, you should probably not even play. And, you know, there's a very good chance that he may be one of only two or three candidates who can do that. So I don't really see a pathway to Michael Bloomberg winning it outright, but I can see a pathway in which he's able to get, you know, 20 to 30% of the delegates nationwide and force a convention fight. You know, I think that's his proposed pathway, you know, logically.
Yeah. If you go back to Iowa, if you should evaluate the top candidates and their chances in Iowa, Biden to Klobuchar.
Yeah. So as you know, we've got a recent poll out, and as you know, you may be aware that there really was about a month without any polling. Part of that has to do with the Christmas, New Year's holidays, and part of it has to do with lazy pollsters, probably. Mm-hmm. But you know, so we just got the first poll out in the longest time, be from Iowa, and it shows us a few things. So on the top line, it shows us that there's a three-way statistical tie between Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg, with Elizabeth Warren in a modestly distant fourth place, technically. And, you know, we see a little bit of rise to Amy Klobuchar, but the truth is she's in a distant fifth. And Amy Klobuchar faces a similar problem to some other candidates in the past. Michelle Bachmann in the Republican primary in 2008 comes to mind, as does Dick Gephardt, the former Speaker of the House in 2004 on the Democratic side, in that she's from a border state. She's from Minnesota. And one of the problems you run into is if you're from a bordering state and you don't win or at least come in second or third, your campaign's pretty much over. And so I expect Amy Klobuchar to drop out after Iowa, frankly. She might stay in through New Hampshire just because of timing purposes. But I don't see her advancing beyond the first contest or two, because she has no hope of winning whatsoever, or even of coming in second at this point. So she will be the first victim of Iowa. Andrew Yang will be interesting. His fundraising is quite a lot better than Ms. Klobuchar's. I think that Andrew Yang will at least have the finances to stay in through South Carolina. I could actually see him being one of those unique people who finishes fourth or fifth, somewhat surprisingly. And for him, that would be a victory, right? Yeah. Whereas for Amy Klobuchar, it's a death knell to get the same exact result. Elizabeth Warren doesn't need to win Iowa, but she needs to come in surprisingly strong if she hopes to win New Hampshire and kind of play the comeback kid role, like Bill Clinton or John McCain. So, you know, she's in real trouble if she comes in fourth. She's in dire straits if she comes in lower than that. A third place finish for her there would be quite respectable, and it's not outside the possibility, because her voters tend to be very sticky, as we'd say. Pete Buttigieg is interesting. Iowa has a history of liking to upset the apple cart. So that's probably the biggest negative for Joe Biden, is if Joe Biden wins Iowa, you know, then it's kind of like, well, what was the point of all of this? Mm. So we'll see what happens. You know, I think that Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg are the most likely to win Iowa. And then likewise, probably come in second accordingly. I could see Joe Biden coming in third, but he could also win. But I believe it's more likely to be something along the lines of Bernie Sanders, then Joe Biden, and then Pete Buttigieg, or perhaps, you know, Pete Buttigieg in second and Joe Biden in third even. And then, of course, that does affect New Hampshire. I think if Bernie Sanders wins or comes in second in Iowa, then he definitely wins New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I find Pete Buttigieg very interesting because, you know, he's sort of the proof that, you know, money isn't everything in American politics. Because here in Europe and in Sweden, a lot of people on the left side, the communist side, they always say that, like, oh, you just need to have money in the United States to become president. But like Pete Buttigieg and even Barack Obama was proof that no, you don't need to have money in the beginning. You only need to have a message and, you know, like a good appearance, then you can win, and then eventually you get money and you win. So I find him very interesting in that regard.
Absolutely. And the one thing I will say, obviously, given my background, if your listeners have listened to me more than once, I am basically a conservative, Republican-leaning libertarian. So obviously I don't really actively support any of these people. That being said, I do find Pete Buttigieg to be an exceptional communicator. And I also have a lot of respect for his, military service in the United States Navy as well. And despite being the first major candidate who's also openly homosexual, he's also more moderate, which in Democratic politics would be to say more conservative than most of his, opposing candidates, with the exception perhaps of Joe Biden and Andrew Yang.
When it comes to Iowa, does Iowa have any special, because we have all these national issues, like now the Iran and things like that, and the economy, jobs and things like that, but does Iowa have any specific issues that the candidate has to address in Iowa specifically?
I mean, Iowa has a couple of key issues that make them stand out. One, of course, is farm policy, and agriculture. They're a major agricultural producing state. It's their number one source of their economy by, head and shoulders above the second or third in their economy. So farm policy has a lot to do with politics there, which puts certain candidates like, Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, who are more urban candidates, to a slight disadvantage. It benefits candidates like Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar, who are used to dealing with more of that kind of political setting. Also, because they have a massive border on the Mississippi River, flooding and flood insurance and these kinds of things pop up there in a way that they don't accept probably in the coastal hurricane areas like Florida. And New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, also in South Carolina. So those are two issues that are somewhat not fully unique to Iowa, but have a far more importance than they would in many, many states, and where you'll get questioned on it at a rate that you wouldn't necessarily expect to. Farm subsidy issues and how to deal with that, which is an issue in Europe as well, as you know. So that's a key element. And Iowa tends to pay attention, similarly because of agriculture, to the foreign trade issue in a way that's a little more frontline and center. So things like Trump's MCA agreement, but also some of the tariffs against China, have disproportionately hurt Iowa, frankly, and give the Democrats a bit of an opening there if they do it correctly. So Iowa, I believe, will be very much in play in the general election. And of course, they voted for Trump in 2016, but Barack Obama in 2012. So it's very, very important to see what will happen with Iowa.
My final question then. Donald Trump, he's a different kind of president, because most president, when the opposing party, the Democrats or the Republicans, goes up for the primaries, the president in the White House usually say that it's not my business. I don't care what the Democrats or the Republicans do. I'm the president. But Donald Trump acts like in the opposite way. He always comments. He said like Snow Woman. He said about Amy Klobuchar, and he said like they call him Mayor Pete, because they don't ha know how to pronounce Buttigieg, so they all say Mayor Pete, Mayor Pete. He's quite funny with Donald
Right.
Trump, but he talks a lot about the Democrat, about the opposing parties. Do you think that is a good strategy for Donald Trump to win his re-election?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things we talk about in electoral politics is defining your opponent. And Donald Trump has made a hallmark of that, most notably through his nicknames that he was rather famously gave, first his primary opponents and then ultimately, Secretary Clinton as well. And so he's shown a willingness to do that this time out. although there's some that, you know, I think, you know, stick better than others, frankly. Yeah, I don't think it's come into focus quite as much yet. I do think that it benefits him that there is a relative chaos, right? The reality is that even though Bernie Sanders has raised quite a bit of money, and likewise Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg have raised considerable amounts of money as well, they've got to spend it against each other. Whereas, you know, President Trump has already raised over $150 million, and he doesn't have to spend any of it other than, you know, obviously they're spending small amounts of money here and there, a lot of digital advertising just to kind of keep the campaign in a you know, non-sleepy form. But, you know, he's going to have the overwhelming majority of that just sort of sitting there waiting for whomever the Democrats ultimately pick. And I expect Trump to have north of $500 million. So, you know, that's something to keep in mind. I don't think that's as big an issue for Bernie Sanders, and certainly it's no issue whatsoever for Mike Bloomberg. He could spend $2.5 billion just for fun and may wind up doing that. That's been the number that he's kind of thrown out quietly that he was prepared to spend, which would be just a staggering sum of money. For your listeners' benefit, that would equal the amount of money that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton's campaign combined spent last election. So it's nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, very interesting. All right. Well, thanks a lot for taking time, Justin. It was good to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Ronnie, and Happy New Year.
Det var avsnitt 1005 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, en podcast som finns för att ge det konservativa perspektiv på USA-valet som svensk media inte ger och som kan stödjas på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0 eller genom att via hemsidan stödja på PayPal, Patreon eller bankkonto. Det var allt för idag. Tack för att ni har lyssnat. Thank you.